Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. This month, folks around town will be discussing this year's One Read selection, The Ruins of Us by Kaya Parsonen. Set in Saudi Arabia in 2005, the novel tells the story of Rosalie March, an American expat married to a wealthy Saudi businessman. Their happy union starts to crumble after she discovers her husband's secret second marriage. The book examines the emotional toll the revelation takes on Rosalie, her husband, her son and daughter, and a family friend. Today on Intersection, we'll talk about the novel with the book's author. In the second half of the show, we'll chat with other local authors about what it's like writing in Colombia. But first, Kaya Parsonen is the author of The Ruins of Us. Born in Saudi Arabia, Kaya moved to the U.S. at the age of 12. She studied at Princeton and the Iowa Writers Workshop before settling in Colombia with her husband. Kaya, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. And we'd love to hear from you and our audience as well. Have you read The Ruins of Us? What did you think of it? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And might as well start off with one of those stereotypical author interview questions, but why did you decide to write this book?
I think it was sort of a welling up, as a lot of debut novels are for their writers. It's this emotional welling up of an idea or a thought that you have, something you want to express in greater detail or explore or examine. And then you just sort of start writing it by chance, or at least that's how it happened for me. I started with just an idea for a scene based on a story, an interesting story my father had written me in an email. And I also began with a mood as well, the mood of nostalgia, of sort of yearning for something that has passed and cannot be reclaimed. And I think that that mood of nostalgia or melancholy sort of permeates the entire book, and for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it really started in a very nebulous way. It wasn't like, I'm going to sit down and write a book, and it's going to, you know, have this story arc, and this is where the climax is going to happen. You know, I really had no plot at all when I started. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why it took me about 5 years to write.
Well, and you mentioned your father. Now, he had just moved to Saudi Arabia, I think. Was it before you had started writing this book? Did that influence the way this book kind of formed and I guess your motivations for writing it too?
Absolutely. Actually, he moved back in 2003 and I had just graduated from college. And so I was doing a lot of soul searching and wondering what I was going to do with my life. And I knew I loved to write. And he would send me these wonderful, long, descriptive emails. He's a bit of a writer himself, definitely. And that brought to life Saudi Arabia again for me in a really visceral way. And I think that sparked this yearning to go back to the country through imaginative exploration. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and to anyone who will read the book, it becomes very quickly clear that the descriptive writing is very heavy throughout this book. And it really paints a picture. So was a lot of that from memory as you're talking about, since, again, you left Saudi Arabia when you were 12 years old? Is that right?
Just shy of my 12th birthday.
Okay.
That's right.
And so so how much of that was from memory or from research, or how did you get to creating those scenes you mentioned earlier?
The Libyan writer Hisham Mattar, he's one of my favorite authors. He spent the first 12 years of his life in Libya, his home country, before fleeing Gaddafi's rule with his family, all except for his father, who was taken prisoner and basically disappeared. They never heard from him again. They don't know definitively if he was killed. They by this point do assume that that is what happened to him. But he talks about, he answers his critics who say, well, you only spent your childhood there. How can you write novels and especially such powerful books that are set in Libya? And he said, you know, the most, and he actually never did return to the country. Mm. Unlike, I actually had the opportunity to return to Saudi Arabia in 2008. So that did help to resuscitate those memories that were definitely starting to fade by the time I'd been gone for, you know, 15 years. Mm-hmm. But he said the memories that you gain in childhood are often the most powerful. They stay with you the longest. And I would agree with that. So I think that my writing The Ruins of Us was a combination of those childhood memories and then more recent ones from my return trip in 2008.
Did you get any criticism like that after the book was released? It's been out for a while now, of someone saying, this outsider who hasn't been here for a long time?
Well, I think not necessarily the amount of time that had elapsed. That wasn't really the problem. It was more like a defensiveness, like, you are an outsider, what are you doing writing about this? I haven't had anybody explicitly say that to me. I think that when you're born in a country and you live there for almost 12 years and your mother grew up there as well, even if you aren't traditionally assimilated into the culture, you do have some claims on the place. And so, at least I like to think so. And so I think that I haven't received that criticism directly, but I imagine that there are people out there who would think that.
Sure. Well, we mentioned it already in the intro as well, but one of the main plot lines in the book is Abdullah, Rosalie's husband, has taken on a second marriage. Where did the idea for that come?
That actually came in a very concrete way. I was in ninth grade, and my mother received a phone call from an old family friend, an American woman who was married to a Saudi man. And in fact, my mother and father had been close to both the husband and the wife. In fact, the husband first, and then the woman who later became his wife. And she was just in tears. She said, you know, you'll never believe it, but he's had the second wife. And actually, this man in real life had been married for 15 years to this other woman without his first wife knowing it. And I remember thinking as a 15-year-old, just being very flabbergasted by this idea that somebody could have two wives. How would you go about doing that? What were the logistics of that? And also, you know, I was just forming my own nascent understanding of romance and marriage. And so it was a bit baffling for me. And I think that really stuck with me. And I revisited it definitely, but in adulthood, and thought, well, this would be a really interesting point at which to open a story. Because, of course, you always want to go where the conflict is. And that will stir things up for sure when you make that kind of discovery.
And as in the book, I'm assuming that was very uncommon at that time, at that point in time, for someone to take on a second wife.
In this particular circle that this man and woman ran in, they were very educated, wealthy, had both, you know, she, of course, had spent her childhood in the United States, but he had several degrees from American schools and was very westernized in many ways. So on the one hand, it was uncommon for that circle of friends, but he was also from the Najd, which is the more conservative central region of the country, and those more tribal traditions sort of hold fast in that area. And so among his family, there were people who, his brothers, who did take second wives as well, unlike in the book, in The Ruins of Us, where I wanted to create this sort of conflict within the family, mm-hmm. where they were looking at Abdullah and saying, you know, we don't really support this, but culturally we sort of have to stand by you. So we will.
Right. And so in doing your research too, I mean, how much were you able to find any writings or anything of women from those situations, or was a lot of it too just realizing what it would feel like to be in that situation, I guess?
You know, a bit of both, definitely. Yeah. So I certainly used my imagination to create Rosalie's trauma and also Abdullah's conflict, too. He does love her in his way, but he's greedy and he feels justified and he can get away with it. And so who doesn't get away with things when they're in that position to do so? So, but I also found this wonderful blog called AmericanBedu.com. And this American woman who was married to a Saudi diplomat for many years, happily, in Riyadh, started this blog because she knew that a lot of Western women were marrying Saudi men and it wasn't turning out very well for the couples because oftentimes the women were pretty ignorant about the culture coming in. And she said, you know, it's not that I want to scare them off and Saudi bash. You know, I had a really wonderful marriage. Her husband died of cancer, unfortunately. But when they were together, it was a very happy situation. She said, I'm not trying to Saudi bash, but I really do want to inform and educate so that when a woman arrives here, she'll be prepared, or she can make the decision not to come if she would like to, once she sort of knows a little bit more about what life is like on the ground here, because we can all have romantic ideas about how our marriage is going to play out. But then once we arrive into this new country and see the reality, it can be pretty harsh. So she had a lot of anonymous posters on her blog that she would invite. She, of course, would know who they were, who were in similar situations, in plural marriage situations. And it was just fascinating to read their emotional responses to it and how they felt about it. And there were a variety of responses to this among both American and Middle Eastern women. So I found it fascinating. And because Saudi society is so private, that was really the only way to access these stories was through this anonymous blog. So there's not a census out there. The Saudi government is not collecting data on how many wives the men in their society have because, of course, they're doing image control and damage control all the time. And they probably don't want that information just floating around for people. It would be yet another thing for people to criticize about their society.
Sure. Well, I just want to take one moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today we're talking with Kaya Parsonen, the author of The Ruins of Us, which is the Danube Boone Regional Library's One Read book this year. This month, folks around town will be discussing this book. Set in Saudi Arabia in 2005, the novel tells the story of Rosalie March, an American expat who discovers her wealthy Saudi husband has a secret second marriage. We'd love to hear from you in our audience. What questions do you have for Kaya Parsonen? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. One other thing about that becomes pretty clear once you make it to the second chapter of your book is that you spend a lot of time telling the story from viewpoints of the different characters. In fact, it seems like characters kind of get a chapter every now and then. Mm-hmm. So what was the motivation? Was that part of your plan when writing this book, or is that just how it kind of flushed out once you started the process of writing this book?
Definitely the latter. That was sort of how it fell into place. It happened pretty organically, and I think mostly because I was fumbling my way through and didn't really know what I was doing. Again, you know, when you're writing a first novel, you're teaching yourself how to write a long piece like that. So it did happen pretty naturally, but I think it serves the book well because it prevents the Saudi characters from being otherized or orientalized, because we are seeing things from their viewpoint, and we see that they are human beings. They're making, you know, we see their rationale for the choices that they're making. We see them as fallible. We see them as having heart and tenderness and emotion. And so I think this book would be far more one-dimensional if it were just told from an American perspective. Now, there are great expat books out there, like Hilary Mantel, one of my favorite authors, wrote a book. She lived in Saudi Arabia for a little bit less than a year with her husband. She lived in, I think she was in Riyadh, and she wrote this book called 8 Months on Gaza Street. And in that book, it sort of tells of this wife who's there with her husband, and she spends all of her time in her apartment, and she starts to imagine the terrible things that are going on in this apartment above her, where she can sort of hear some muffled noises and thumps and bumps in the night. And so there is this sense of fear and terror of the other. And of course, it creates a really interesting, taut, suspenseful mystery, but it doesn't really delve into Saudi society. It's definitely the expat, the outsiders versus, you know, this sort of dark Heart of Darkness of mm-hmm. Saudi culture. And so that's one approach to it, but that was not the one that I wanted to take.
Sure. And was it important, too, because we have characters from different generations as well, right? Was that important, too, in trying to make the book relatable to a reader, I guess?
I think so. I think that one of the beautiful things about Maryam is she represents sort of hope for the future of the country and hope for change. And she is, you know, she's nobody's fool. She's perhaps the moral voice of the book, and she kind of calls everyone out on their bad decisions. And so it was important for me to get the young perspective. And then, of course, the other side of that coin is her brother Faisal and his fervor of a different nature, which is certainly more dangerous, but definitely exists in that culture, as in most cultures. You have sort of an edgy, youthful, fundamentalist fervor. We have it here in our own country in certain corners. So I wanted to examine that as well.
Right. And those characters, Abdullah and Faisal, both can be unlikable at some points during the book. How did you work with that as well, I guess?
You know, it's interesting. I get a lot of responses from readers who are just angry at my characters. I couldn't believe. I remember my yoga instructor, Polly. She was like, "I was so mad at Faisal when he kidnapped his mom." Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Oh shoot. Okay. We'll try to give you a warning on those. That's fine.
So she was just like, "Oh, what a little stinker," you know. And it's just fun when people, you know, it wasn't like she hated him or thought he was evil. She just had a strong reaction to him. And so I think that good books can elicit those strong reactions in us as readers, and they're not always happy reactions either. A lot of times, you know, some of my favorite books are books that make me cry or that make me just so angry at the injustice. It makes me want to sort of go out there and fix something or do something about it. So
yeah, something challenging, right?
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. So I think, and I certainly think Dan and Rosalie have their unlikable moments as well. They are certainly flawed. So basically no one's a hero in this book.
And then I guess, well, talking about, we already gave one quick little spoiler, but that's okay. But talking about the ending of the book, was that, again, in the process of writing the book, did you have an ending in mind, or did that also come about organically? How did that process work out too, I guess?
Well, it's really interesting. When I was at Iowa, a lot of authors came through and talked to us, and perhaps the most annoying was John Irving, because he said, "You know, I always know exactly how my books are going to end. I have the last line like written down before I even begin." And we're all just like, "Oh man, like, that is so not the way my process works." You know, and of course he's a master storyteller, so I can only envy that kind of control. But I certainly did not possess it with the writing of this book, nor with the writing of my second book, which I'm still working on revising. But I have finished a first draft. I think the ending, you can never really know the ending if you sort of allow yourself to be borne along by the writing and by the characters. And they do sort of begin to act on their own, of their own devices, and have their own sort of path that they follow, which I think is just interesting to let them kind of go down that path and see what happens. And then, of course, your job at the end is to create an ending that is maybe not neatly tied up with a bow, but is satisfying in some way to your readers, while maybe not betraying the messiness that is life that a book should reflect.
Right. Well, and you mentioned you went to the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, and then we'll talk later in the second half hour of the show about the workshop you work with here in Columbia as well. But did you ever workshop this book or work with others, obviously of course, with editors, but who else did you work with throughout the process on this book?
You know, this was the book that I submitted as my writing sample to get into Iowa.
Oh, really?
I submitted, you know, one of the early chapters from this book, and one of the chapters that actually remains in the finished version in a slightly different form. And so I workshopped chapters of this book throughout my time at Iowa. I think I only workshopped one short story because I got a bit obsessed with the book, and I didn't want to take time to write a story that I could then workshop in class while working on my novel sort of in the dark of the night, which a lot of my classmates were able to do. And I admire that ability to multitask because I do not possess it. I just have to sort of see one project through to the end. And so it was really hard to workshop novel chapters in class because people would only get to see, you know, 30 to 60 pages every semester. And so sometimes they would just have the total wrong ideas for how the book should develop. But then other times people would really get it and they'd have really crucial suggestions that they made. In fact, one of my classmates I'm very indebted to, because he said, you know, that I originally had Rosalie die at the end in the first draft that I wrote. And he said, you know, I just think that makes it too easy on everybody else. If you have her live, then people have to sort of deal with the choices that they've made. And while she's sort of sitting right there in the middle of the living room. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I'm grateful to him because I think it's much more interesting and complex the way it is now.
I want to take one more moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuller, and today we're talking with Kaya Parsonen, the author of The Ruins of Us, which is the Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read book this year. This month, folks around town will be discussing this book. Set in Saudi Arabia in 2005, the novel tells the story of Rosalie March, an American expat who discovers her wealthy Saudi husband has a secret second marriage. We'd love to hear from you and our audience. What questions do you have for Kaya Parsonen? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Were there any particular chapters of these? Again, each character kind of gets a chapter. We hear, obviously, different viewpoints as well. But were there any of the chapters that were specifically difficult to write for certain characters, I guess?
You know, definitely it was more difficult for me to get into Abdullah's point of view. He was certainly the most difficult character for me to write. He's probably the most different from me of all of the other characters. And so I really struggle to find his voice. But I think once you sort of, you know, you just keep writing pages and pages and try to wait and see if it falls into place. Sometimes it doesn't happen and you just have to abandon that character's voice and maybe decide not to represent them in the book. But then sometimes it might just be a turn of phrase that will happen and you're like, oh yeah, this is how he views the world. I'm in his head now. And for me, that moment is when he's walking to his office and he's sort of looking around him and seeing all these sort of peaceful parts of his routine that he typically enjoys, but he's really angry that morning at his wife and his son and his daughter. Everybody's misbehaving. And I thought, yeah, this is a man who wants things to be easy for himself. He doesn't want to deal with this stuff, this messy stuff. And of course, he's been part of creating the mess, but he can't admit that to himself at that point. So I was like, okay, yes, this is who he is. He's sort of conflicted and entitled, charming in some ways, and then infuriating in others.
We actually have a caller on the line. I wanted to bring her on, Teresa from Columbia. Oh, that sounds like we don't have Teresa from Columbia anymore. But fortunately, I know what she was wanting to ask. She wanted to know if you ever thought about what happened to the characters after the book's end.
That's a great question, too. And I've visited several book clubs here in Columbia, and a lot of the people in those clubs ask me that question. They often think, well, is there going to be a sequel? There has to be a sequel because you left things sort of open-ended. And, you know, they're a little disappointed to hear that there's going to be no sequel because that open-endedness was intentional. And so I do think about them, and I wonder about them. And it's not necessarily that I know exactly how things are going to play out for them either. So it's like old friends that you haven't seen in a long time. I sort of think of them with fondness, but also with anxiety, especially for Faisal. You know, Abdullah has his wife and his new baby, so I think he'll be okay. You know, he'll mourn the loss of Rosalie, who's going to leave, but I think he'll move on. But with Faisal going to the United States to study, living with his uncle, you know, having to grapple with the fallout from his decision with his mother, I worry for him, and he's sort of at a crossroads in his life, in his young life. So I kind of wonder where he's going to end up. I have hope for him, though.
Well, we talked earlier a little bit about some of the reactions to the book, too. I wonder specifically your Saudi friends that read the book, what were their reactions to it?
Well, I had two Saudi friends who read it start to finish, and they were both really helpful to me and supportive of the process. And then another friend who was just very supportive. He and his daughter never read it, but they wanted to. They just didn't have the time to. And they were just very supportive throughout the process. And the friends who read it thought it was interesting. They thought it could be a little bit incendiary, certainly. And they could see, they knew my family very well, so they could see the threads of it that represented my family's autobiography. And so I think that's what they found sort of the most perplexing is that I would dare to write about my family in such an open way. And I think that is the terrifying thing that a writer does, is you sort of lay out your worldview and your emotions on the page for everybody to see. But they were very supportive. I had some friends, two that I can think of my father's friends, that I had asked certain questions. I had some research questions for them, and so I sort of gave them a synopsis of the book and said, so here's my basic question, can you help me out with this? And I was so sad to hear their response, which was, well, we thought you were writing a positive portrayal of Saudi Arabia. This doesn't sound very positive at all. This is a man taking a second wife, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, my answer to that was that the fiction writer is not a propagandist. We don't set out to write anything positively or negatively, or if we do, we're not really doing our job right. Mm-hmm. So we just set out to explore and examine relationships within a society. And so, and of course, there's always an edge of the critical to that examination. So I was sad to have disappointed them, but I think the writer just has to steel herself for angering and disappointing lots of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So did that really surprise you that that was their reaction? I mean, like you said, you knew what you were doing, I guess.
You know, I think I was so young when I started this book. Yeah. I was 25. And so I think it still hurt me and did surprise me. But at the same time, it sort of hardened me and prepared me for the writer's role. You do have to be rather tough and thick-skinned. And believe in what you have to say, and that it's not, you know, a sort of depiction of any one person or society as being evil or terrible. I think I got over that feeling of guilt pretty quickly.
Sure. Well, and I won't ask you to air all your dirty laundry here, but you did say there were some connections to your family. I wonder, was Faisal based on anyone in particular, I guess, that character?
You know, he is the one character who's just wholly from my imagination. Okay. And I think he sprung out of, you know, my deepest, darkest unconscious after 9/11, just a lot of the fear and anxiety that I had, the questions that I had about these young men who were making these choices to give their life for this cause. And I found it so fascinating and compelling and horrifying in many ways. And, you know, my second book actually examines a different kind of fundamentalism here in the United States. So I think I can start to see what my obsessions are, which I'm just very fixated on religious fundamentalism and its ills, and the negative repercussions it can have, particularly on young people.
And again, we went over your personal history before growing up in Saudi Arabia, then moving. There was a lot of that theme throughout the book, the idea of moving from one place to another, Faisal at the end of the book. How much of your experience played into what we saw on the page there?
Well, it's interesting. There's actually a term for people like me who grew up in one place and then spent the later part of their life in another, and it's third culture kids. And it's because, you know, they don't really belong to either of the two cultures where they've spent their life. They feel sort of perpetually an outsider, and so they sort of create their own culture sort of above the mix. And I do feel that way. So you're sort of homeless. You don't really have a solid grasp on where home is for you. And I know a lot of my friends who grew up as Aramco brats, that's the word for what we were, the oil brats, feel the same way. And this sense of loss when you leave Saudi Arabia, because you feel that it's home and yet you can't return to it. So, and that has definitely stayed with me and stayed with my mom. Her melancholy is definitely was an inspiration for Rosalie's feelings and her yearning to go back to Saudi Arabia.
And now you're in Colombia. how are you feeling in regards to all that now, I guess?
You know, it's interesting, but I think writing this book was very therapeutic for me. So it helped me process a lot of those feelings and that feeling of unsettledness that I had hung on to for a long time. And especially the return trip to Saudi Arabia allowed me to see the country again with fresh eyes and just sort of restock my memories. And so I feel very sort of satisfied with my relationship with Saudi in a way that I never had before and probably wouldn't have if I hadn't written this book.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking with Kaya Parsonen, the author of The Ruins of Us, which is the Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read book this year. For the next half hour of the show, we'll be joined by other local authors to talk about what it's like writing in Colombia. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumioner, and today we've been talking with Kaya Parsonen, the author of The Ruins of Us, which is the Columbia One Read book this year. Many Mid-Missourians will spend some time this month discussing the book at events throughout the area. For the second half of our discussion today, we're joined by two more local authors to talk about what it's like writing in Mid-Missouri. Alex George is an Oxford-educated author and a lawyer who lives in Columbia. He wrote four novels published in the UK and Europe, and his American debut called A Good American was published last year. Alex, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Marlene Lee is the author of The Absent Woman, which was published earlier this year. She lives in Columbia and takes part in the Quarry Heights Writers Workshop with Kaya, which we'll undoubtedly be talking a little about today. Marlene, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. And we'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Do you think of Columbia as a literary community? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. And that kind of seems like a good question to start us off with, too, I guess. Is Columbia a literary community? It seems like you all might know best. Alex?
I mean, I think it is. I think it's extraordinary the number of people, the number of writers who are in this small town. It seems that you can't turn a corner without finding another one somewhere, and someone's just published another book or a book. I mean, it's amazing. And I was wondering why that might be, and I'm not entirely sure. I think it made it. Obviously, the university would be the obvious thing, but when you think about, and I don't know about you, Marlene, but I mean, I certainly didn't come here because of the university. I don't think you did either.
No.
So if that is the case, there are some other fortuitous things that have happened as well. That, you know, and we've all just landed here, and it's fabulous.
Right. Marlene or Kay, you have any thoughts on that? Just what might make Columbia a haven for an author?
I think it's partly the university, as Alex says, because you have a lot of readers here. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of people who love to read, and they will attend readings. They have reading series here. The Quarry Heights Writing Workshop was kind of a center for me. I'm going to go back again to the Writers' Workshop this fall. There's a couple of spots still empty because it generates a lot of creativity and a lot of knowledge about craft, the craft of writing. That mm-hmm. got me started. Mm-hmm. There's the Orr Street Studio Readings. There's the Boone County Historical Society Readings, where I first heard Alex read.
Right.
And where
fabulous.
I will,
those
I'll hear you. Yeah. You
we
were supposed
have
to
about 60 people, I think, who
I
attend
know.
Those.
Oh, wow. You were
That's
supposed
incredible.
To read this month, but you were otherwise occupied.
That's right.
It's a busy
That's
month
right.
for you. Yeah.
But it's a rich place. The bookstores are willing to have you read. And, you know, that's what a writer needs, to be
and
heard.
And to carry your book as well. Yellow Dog Bookshop and Columbia Books.
That's right.
Both make sure to carry signed copies by local authors. I just bought a memoir by Nina Furstenau and was very excited to do that at Yellow Dog yesterday. And so it's just exciting to walk in and know, well, that's one of my friend's books. And heck, I'm going to buy it and get her to sign it. So I also think one of the things that makes Columbia a good place for writers is it's inexpensive to live here. Mm-hmm. So particularly if you're just starting out on your path, you might not be rolling in dough. And so it's really nice to pay not very much in rent and to have enough to do, but not so much that you're distracted constantly. I'm actually always, I listen to my friends who live in New York in wonderment, kind of I'm fascinated by how they ever get any work done with how much goes on there. And Marlene, you've written in New York.
I lived in New York until a year ago, May. I lived there for 11 years. I moved there from San Francisco because I sort of wanted to, I thought, well, I'll absorb some New York literary life. That's why I haven't been published. I'm not New York enough. It didn't happen in New York. You know where it happened? Columbia, Missouri.
Well, what is – you guys have all written and lived other places as well around the country, around the world. What is different in those places than the situation here, I guess, in the life of an author, I guess, and like Kay was mentioning, the workflow, I guess, and just making it happen?
Well, I think Kay is right. Being in a small town does mean that there are fewer distractions, which means that you can just sit knuckle down and sit down and do your book. And again, I agree with her about the cost of living. That can certainly be helpful. I think also, you know, there are an awful lot of good coffee shops. There are lots of highly caffeinated people with their laptops who are all typing away, and that probably helps as well. But yes, I mean, I lived in London for 13 years before I came here, and I did write several books while I was there, but it's certainly the pace of life is a little slower here. And, you know, when you write, you need to take the time to think about things deeply and slowly, and so that's helpful for sure.
Right. Well, and how do you get a publisher who's not here to pay attention to you? How does that work, I guess, or does it work?
It
does,
it
apparently.
Is,
we got everybody
some
here's
of it
both.
Is luck.
Yeah.
I went to the Missouri Writers Guild Columbia chapter, sat down next to Susan Finlay, a mystery writer, and she told me about her editor in England, because my publisher's English. Mm-hmm. And I wrote him, and he was more open than literary agents in New York. He was very open. We clicked. He liked my work. Another thing about New York is every other person in New York is a writer. You know, but here it's kind of special still. Mm-hmm. And so I feel an identity as a writer here in New York. I just felt like, that's another unpublished writer.
Yeah.
Dime a dozen.
You're in a coffee shop and everybody's tapping away on their computers and you're like, you know, there's a sense of, well, I better write faster or else he's going to get published.
Your novel's
me.
Better than mine.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, because certainly I've, in all of the people who I've met being in Columbia, the sense of community that there is for between writers is wonderful. There isn't a shred, as far as I'm aware, of competitiveness anywhere. Everybody's extremely supportive, and the workshop that Kaya started is probably the best example of that. And everyone is willing to, whether it's cajoling or encouraging, or what they will do what people need to do. And, you know, if people require help, if people have asked me to read manuscripts, and I'm always happy to do that. And there's a wonderful sense of, you know, because writing is a lonely job. More than anything else, and having any kind of community, and lots of writers are on Twitter and Facebook and all of those wonderful social media things. There's nothing quite like being able to sit down over a cup of coffee, and whether you're moaning about your agent or you're moaning because you've got writer's block or you can't resolve this particular plot point, it doesn't matter. Having somebody who's right there, and there are enough people who actually understand that process, because people who don't write maybe voracious readers, but there comes a point where the barriers come down, and say, you know, I don't really know what you're talking about, unless you've been there and gone through it and slogged through it, and having all of these people to talk to and moan at can be it's a good thing.
Well, and maybe that is a good time to talk about the Quarry Heights workshop. Kaya, maybe tell us a little bit about what that is, I guess, first. And I'm sure many of our listeners aren't familiar with it.
Sure. It's the Quarry Heights Writers Workshop, and I started it about 3 years ago. I'd been in Columbia about a year, and I was struck by this fact that every other person I seemed to meet was engaged in some creative undertaking, and many of them were writers. And I joined an informal writers group of women here and was just eager to get back to a kind of workshop setting. I also really enjoy teaching. I taught at Iowa for a year and loved that undertaking, and felt like I learned a lot about how to write from teaching. And so I started the workshop, and we had a first class in winter of 2011, and 8 people around my kitchen table. And we now meet up at Columbia Independent School, so we have a bit more space. It was a little cramped in my tiny house, which is in Quarry Heights, hence the name. And it was just a great way for me to meet other writers here and to sort of foster community. And we, at the end of every workshop, we have a community-wide reading that's open to anybody and everyone. And everybody who took the class gets to read for about 5 minutes from their work. And it's sort of BYOB. People bring wine and food, and we just hang out and enjoy each other's company. And so I think that's probably my favorite part about it, is that sense at the end of that festiveness of those readings.
And those readings are wonderful. I mean, I went to one, I don't know which one it was, but at PS Gallery. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who I'd known for a long time stood up halfway through and began to read a children's story that she had written. I had no idea that she...
It was Holly. Yeah.
And I had no idea that she was even a writer. And so, you know, you talk about writers everywhere. It's exactly right.
And then you had the open mic, which you got together at the Berlin Cafe, and there were many, many people there. I don't know. There must have been 100 people.
Well, wow.
It
that
was incredible.
Maybe 100. I would say at least 50. There was a nice crowd there, and Eli Gay over at Cafe Berlin opened up his space for us in the evening, and we just invited, again, it was open to the whole community, and had people sign up when they got there with a, you know, little bio, and then it was hosted by, emceed by Shane Epping, who's a photographer here at Mizzou, for the university, and he did a fantastic job. And I, again, I was just amazed by the quality of the work and the bravery of the people who were willing to get up there and share it. And also, it was nice for me as a professional writer to see once again these writers who are doing this while they're doing their day job, while they're working and raising children and all of this, and managing to carve out some time to write a poem or write a short story. And it just reminded me that, you know, that to get back to that passion and that drive, that's where it all starts.
Okay. We actually have a caller on the line I'd like to bring on, Kathy Salter from Columbia. Kathy, are you there?
Yes, I wanted to say hello to three people who have been wonderful participants in the Boone County Museum's Saturday morning book talks that began about a year ago and are now bringing in 60 to 90 people. Alex, I think, in December, and Marlene earlier this year when her book came out. And Kayo was actually supposed to do a presentation this month, but of course she's doing about 100 other presentations this month. But this is an example of how something we began not really knowing who the community of writers were, and the community of writers is so supportive here in Columbia that they have come month after month to hear each other and celebrate each other's publications of books, like Nina Fursenow, who you mentioned, who now has a second book coming out. So it's a richness in the same way that we have this wonderful art community, and now we're having an overlapping of art and writing, as in the Columbia Art League interpretations exhibit earlier this month. And
Kathy, I asked all the panelists here, I wonder your thoughts on why does this happen in Columbia? Why in mid-Missouri is this possible that we would have – I mean, Alex has been saying this is somewhat unique to this a town this size.
It's because the Salters are here.
They came from New York, from England, from KF, from Saudi Arabia and Texas. I grew up moving all over the place and came here in 1988 with my husband. And writing hadn't happened in my life until I came here. It's almost as though you're collecting from your life, and then you come here, and this place gives us the room to breathe, to sit down and let the writing come out. You don't have to be from this place, but there is something quite magical about this mid-Missouri world that has touched something in each of us that says, write. It's time to write. So it's why I know I need to live here. and it seems to be working for the three people you have in the room with you in the same way.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, have a good day. I guess we haven't heard from you, Marlene, on what you get out of Quarry Heights, because you take part in that as well, and being a part of that community.
Yes. Kaya and Lynn Shorey, who helps her teach, do very fine line edits, for one thing, to help, you know, a bad sentence. You look at a sentence and you read it so many times, you don't realize, there's something wrong with this. And they'll tell you. And also, they have the ability to look at the big picture and say, I think on one of my manuscripts, Kaya, you wrote, I'm on page 60 and I don't know what this book is about. So I put that in brackets.
It was much nicer than it sounded.
It was out of
love,
right?
No, you needed to be tough. You needed to be tough with me because, you know, a writer doesn't really want to hear that criticism. So I put the comments in brackets in the manuscript. Then when I'm going back through it, I see these brackets and I go, and later I think she was right. Mm-hmm. I'm on page 60, and I didn't know where the book was going.
And you often can't know that until you reach the end of the draft anyway.
Right.
So you just sort of fumble through, and then
yes.
You can go back and tighten it up and
exactly.
Shore it up. And it helps, I think, just from my experience at Iowa, and then I did take workshops in Brooklyn, to have this community of people who, you know, it's more than an informal writing group where people aren't really required to respond to your work or read it really thoughtfully. And it's I really do request that everybody write a 1 to 2 page critique letter of the two people who put up work that week, of their work, and really thoughtful, you know, and obviously tone is very important in these letters. They're not intended to bash or make anybody feel bad. They're just meant to give constructive criticism and also praise what's going well mm-hmm. with the manuscript mm-hmm. too. And so I miss that community, and you know, I would like to. Maybe I'll take Lynn's class this fall. Lynn Shorey is teaching. Right. It's very valuable, I think, to have fresh eyes on your work.
And it's good to have a deadline, too. Right. Oh, I'm going to be read next week. I'd better get busy and give some fresh pages.
Mm-hmm. Alex, how do you make it work? What's your motivation on getting through these processes we're talking
about? Well, terror. Of various things. I mean, I have a deadline for my next book, which is which I need to deliver in February. And, yeah, that keeps me motivated. And I get up at 5 o'clock every day and start tapping madly. I mean, I've never – well, with one exception, I was in a workshop in London for a little while, oddly with mostly expat Americans, funny, who are living
– And now the tables have turned, yeah.
Yes, living in London. And I don't – I haven't really done – well, certainly haven't done it here. And I enjoyed the experience. It was a worthwhile experience when I was over there. I'm not quite sure why I haven't done it here. I mean, I have every writer has readers who are their sort of resources, and I have, you know, I have two agents, and I have an editor, and all of these people, and but they need to be treated very carefully, because you can only read something for the first time once. And so I was actually having a conversation with my editor at Penguin a few months ago, and she was saying, well, I can read it if you like. And I was going, well, no, I really want to wait until I've got to the end before I deliver it, because, when, you know, you only get that
relationship,
one.
Right?
It is.
It's not just a friendly, you know, let me take a look. They've paid you money, and they want to see that you can deliver a product.
Right. So my agents read it, and they sort of reported back to the editor and said, think it's okay, but it's and that relationship between an editor and a writer is an extraordinarily delicate but infinitely rewarding one when it works well. And I remember when I first signed my contract for A Good American with Penguin, my editor, who's called Amy Einhorn, and I talked for 3 hours on the telephone one afternoon, and we were just trying to work out whether we could work with each other. She needed to know that I was going to be able to take editorial comment, and I needed to know that she wasn't going to say, well, could we maybe add some vampires in here? Or I guess these days it would be, could we maybe have some handcuffs in here? So just to make sure that we were sort of on the same page, if you'll pardon the pun. And we were. And so we had this three-hour conversation. I then got a 9-page single-space letter from her saying, these are all the things you need to change. So I then went off into a hole for 6 months and did all of that work. But that sort of input... and the book is a much, much better book as a result of it. And it can be a bit of a lottery how good your editor is. Mine is wonderful. And I feel extraordinarily lucky to have her. But so there's that level. And then there is also just a more casual sort of reader, and people who just read it, for my last book at least, read along the way and so say, and just be encouraging. Because there are times, I said earlier on, that it's a very lonely job writing books. And there are times you just need to reach out and say, would you mind looking at this, please, and tell me it's not terrible? Because you do, every writer is assailed by self-doubt all the time. And yeah, just occasionally we all need a little prod. Mm-hmm.
That's true. In fact, when Raymond approached me about the show and was
our
talking about
the show.
Writers' community, I thought, wasn't that an oxymoron in some ways? You are just operating in a very solitary way for the majority of the time. And then when you come out of your hole, you do want to have people there to pat you on the back or, you know, be
but
a shoulder to cry
need,
on.
You
or,
need to go back into that hole for real creative work, because
yes.
It's all this networking and stuff. It's fun.
It's exhausting.
But... that's not how the work gets done.
No. You've got to show up. You've got to show up at the page and. Yeah. Do
I think
the work.
There were people at Iowa who spent the entire 2 years, I think, drinking whiskey in the Foxhead Bar, and that was their 2 years there, because it's so easy talking shop. It's
right.
So easy to talk about writing
and not do it.
And we talked about Corey Heights again. We talked about the workshop. I don't know that everybody necessarily gets the concept. Is it a little bit of both? Is it also the camaraderie, but also, I mean, we talked about you're doing line edits, you're looking over manuscripts,
it's work.
And it's mainly work.
Right. It is work. Serious. It's like an academic class. It's a more academic approach. I know there are some workshops where you'll show up and they'll give you prompts and you sort of do free writing. But the Quarry Heights model is sort of the university model. It's that you're coming, you're presenting pages. Everyone's going to read them carefully and thoughtfully, respond to them in a letter. And in class, we discuss it. We talk about what's going right, and then we talk about what needs some improvement. And it's really getting down to the art form and how things are working on a sentence level mm-hmm. and a craft level, which I think is, you know, it's important even for professional writers to kind of return to that state of studenthood.
Mm-hmm. I mean, writing is a craft like everything else. And one hopes that, you know, you start not knowing very much. And the more you do, the better you get. And anybody who ever thinks that they know all that there is to know is probably not going to be that great a writer. You always need to be striving to improve. So that sort of models is clearly one that's
going to
work.
You're going to be told when you've done something well, but you're not going to get empty compliments at Quarry Heights workshop.
I better take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about three local authors, about what it's like to write in Columbia. We're joined by Alex George, an author and lawyer who lives in Columbia, whose most recent novel, A Good American, was published last year. Marlene Lee is from Columbia and is the author of The Absent Woman, which was published earlier this year. And Kaya Parson is the author of The Ruins of Us, which is the Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read book this year. For you and our audience, what would you like to know about what it's like to try to become a published author? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We've talked a lot about the good things about being a writer in Missouri, but what are some of the challenges, especially on that hurdle of getting published? I mean, you mentioned that you have an agent, Alex, and that probably helps a lot, but do publishers just look at you sideways when you say I'm from Missouri, or how do you get over that hump? How is that successful, I guess?
I mean, I can only speak for myself. I mean, because I began my career in London, which I guess was a slightly more usual place to be writing books from than here. Certainly when I moved to Columbia, people were sort of going, I'm sorry, where? But I don't think that people who sit in their glass towers in Manhattan really care where a writer writes. I think that what they care about are the words on the page and the stories that are told, and if they work and if they resonate and if they ring true, that's all they really care about.
Yeah. Two of the greatest writers that I'm really enjoying right now, Daniel Woodrell, lives in Missouri. Lives in the Ozarks, right, which is where his books, he's the author of Winter's Bone, and he's absolutely fantastic. And I think Alex is right. People don't really care where you come from. And in fact, agents are so eager to find and open to finding writers anywhere that they do read their slush piles. And in fact, there was a wonderful success story for one of the Quarry Heights writers, Laura McHugh, whose book recently sold to Spiegel & Grau. It's an imprint of Random House in an auction, and it was really exciting. And she just started out by sending query letters to agents, you know, to dozens of agents, and saying, this is what my book is about. And those letters were read, and her pages were read, and she was found by a wonderful agent who then was able to sell the book very successfully. So it can happen, and that's sort of the enticing thing, I think, for any writer out right. there, is that dream does feel sort of just within reach. And I would say, you know, it's something that you just have to sort of pursue diligently, first and foremost with just writing a really great book, and then sort of getting around to the business side of it and searching out agents.
That's exactly right. And what I would say, I mean, if you look at the numbers and the statistics of the number of people who say they're writing a book, or who are writing a book, or who maybe even have finished a book, the number of those people who will ever find an agent or get published is terrifyingly small, and nobody in their right mind would begin this process just with that in mind. I mean, you have to really want to write for the sake of writing. Yes. And if you get published, that's wonderful, but it's very much a bonus. It's otherwise there would be, you know, because the chance, I mean, we're sitting here and we're all, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I feel extraordinarily lucky to be here.
I can speak to that point. I wrote for 30 years. I wrote 12 novels. And my first novel that was published is actually the fifth one that I wrote. And the one coming out in November is the sixth one that I wrote. Mm-hmm. And what kept me going 30 years wasn't that I just flagellated myself and said, you've got to keep... No, I just couldn't not write. And I decided that was my life. Right. I would be a writer. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, better to fail in a romantic way, like I did my best, than to just finally say, oh, I throw in the towel. No, I wanted to write, and I did write.
Yours is a great, great story, Marlene. And her book, The Absent Woman, is wonderful. I just finished it about 2 weeks ago and really enjoyed it.
Well, I have there's a few questions from the chat room I want to try to get in. We just have a few minutes left in the show. One of them is from a listener named Scott, asked, what books are on your must-read lists right now?
Well, the best book I've read this year is All That Is by James Salter. And he hasn't written a book for 30 years, I don't think, and this one was probably worth the wait. It is the most extraordinary novel I've read in years. It's just got everything in it. It's just brilliant. So if you read one book this year, read that one.
Mm. He is wonderful and really underrated, think, too. He's kind of a writer's writer.
He is very much a writer's
Definitely.
Writer.
Very lyrical. I would say... one of the best books I've read this year is called Cartwheel, and it's actually out in a couple of weeks. It's written by Jennifer Dubois. It takes on the sort of themes of the Amanda Knox story, so this innocent abroad who gets caught up in this this murder and this investigation gone horribly awry. And it asks really fascinating existential questions, and it's just hugely entertaining. It's very funny. It's fast-paced. It's a good page-turner. It's sort of everything a literary, suspenseful literary book should be. So.
Do you have any recommendations?
I tend to read some of the older classics over again.
I
do have James Salter on my bedside table, and that's you've nudged me toward picking that up tonight. But I love Willa Cather. She's Midwestern. And she isn't talked about too much, but she's a fabulous writer. She inspires me.
Okay, I have another question. This one specifically for Kaya, talking about your book, The Ruins of Us. As a writer, how would you feel if this book was made into a movie? Would it upset you to see a screenwriter possibly and misinterpret the characters? Or would the religious theme be too controversial? That was from Nicole Wash in the chat room earlier.
Interesting. I would be thrilled if it were ever made into a movie at the outset of things. But I think once you go and see the movie, I remember Scott Spencer, who was one of my teachers at Iowa, his wonderful book Endless Love, which is a classic, was made into probably one of the worst movies of all time. And he said he showed up for the debut and the director just said, kind of look away, like don't just pretend it's not happening.
Oh.
So it can go horribly wrong, I think. I would worry that these characters would become sort of stock characters in the way that Hollywood has a tendency to do. I think it would need to be handled by a director who could sort of handle more subtle themes and depictions of characters. That would be really important to me because I certainly wouldn't want this book to be used as propaganda, anti-Islamic propaganda in any way, shape, or form.
We just have about 40 seconds before the end of the show. I'll ask this nice stereotypical ending question. What are you all working on now? What's next?
The new novel is called A History of Flight, I think, and it's set in Maine in the 1970s, and it's about friendships and punk rock.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, I want to read that book.
I'm working on a novel that I was working on in Quarry Heights, Edgefield, set in Salina, Kansas.
And okay. I am working on The Girls of Port Sabine, which will come out from Harper Books in 2015. And it follows a group of high school girls and an outbreak of mass hysteria in their high school.
Okay. Well, that's it for today's Intersection. Thanks so much to our guests, local authors, Kaya Parsonen, Alex George, and Marlene Lee. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Sarah Harkins and Casey Morrell. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Femuehlner. Thanks for joining us today and have a great week.